This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
After 4 days of talks, there seems to be some meeting of minds at the Democratic Republic of Congo's political dialogue. Politicians from the ruling coalition and from an opposition grouping agree that holding elections this year is not realistic and are looking at a date from next May onwards.
That's Nick Long reporting from Kinshasa. Details next also. Rights groups criticize the government of Gambia on the worsening human rights situation in the country. And the UN welcomes the final stage of removal of Libya's chemical weapons. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour: after 4 days of talks, there seems to be some meeting of minds at the Democratic Republic of Congo's political dialogue. Politicians from the ruling coalition and from an opposition grouping agree that holding elections this year is not realistic and are looking at a date from next May onwards. Nick Long has more from Kinshasa.
Only a few of the Democratic Republic of Congo's opposition parties are at this dialogue, and their presence is viewed with suspicion by the others. But they say there are real issues that need to be discussed and agreed if the DRC is to hold peaceful elections. The presidential elections were supposed to be held before the end of this year, since President Joseph Kabila's second term ends in December, and under the constitution he is limited to 2 terms. But the ruling coalition has argued for some time that holding elections this year is unrealistic because the list of voters needs updating, and according to the Electoral Commission, this will take 16 months. Experts agree there are 3 options for dealing with the voters' list. One option is not to add new voters who have come of age since 2011. That way, elections before December are still conceivable. But ruling coalition spokesman Leonard Sheokitundu argued Thursday this option would also be unconstitutional.
Alors là, c'est violer la Constitution par rapport au principe de l'inclusivité. Mais l'avantage de ce côté-là, c'est de respecter le délai constitutionnel.
It would mean violating the constitutional principle of inclusivity, he says. The constitutional time limit could be respected, but keeping to the time limit while excluding half the electors is not acceptable. It's been widely said here that there should be about 45 million voters on the voters' list, whereas currently there are only 23 million. A second option is to partially revise the list, and a third is to totally revise it. The ruling coalition favours the third option, and according to Sheokitundu, that is the dominant view at the dialogue. Opposition spokesman Jean-Lucien Mbusa told media the debate on these options continues. He did not say which option the opposition favours, but he suggested the government has effectively made it impossible to hold elections this year.
Considérons aussi que le gouvernement de la République a créé tous les mécanismes pour éviter.
He says his group thinks the government has created all the mechanisms for avoiding holding the presidential elections on time, and responsibility for this must be made clear.
Experts from the United Nations and from the International Organization of French-speaking Countries, La Francophonie, believe the voters list could be fully revised and elections held within about 10.5 months. Another opposition spokesman, Basile Olongo, from the same party as Jean-Lucien Mbusa, suggested this would be acceptable. He says there may be an overrun from the constitutional time limit of 4 or 5 months, but the sky won't fall in. The essential thing, he says, is to organize the elections well, to avoid giving President Kabila a third mandate, and to consolidate the country's democracy. The ruling coalition and opposition spokesman all said a dialogue committee will decide how the voters' list should be updated. Nick Long for VOA News, Kinshasa.
Rights groups continue to criticize the government of Gambia on the worsening human rights situation in the country. They condemn what they refer to as systematic intimidation and harassment of the main opposition United Democratic Party following the death of 2 of its executive members in detention in the last 6 months. 15 members of the UDP have been jailed for 3 years. They've been charged with various offenses, including organizing a protest without a permit and for violating the Public Order Act. Dakar-based reporter in Senegal, Alpha Diallo, spoke with Marta Colomer Aguiler of Amnesty International. He asked her for her reactions on developments in the Gambia.
Amnesty is really concerned because we are talking about two men that were in custody and that have died. So Amnesty is calling for an investigation into what happened to these people and for those responsible of these deaths to be brought to justice.
Apart from also the death of Solo Sendeng and Ibrahim Nkrumah, most of the top brass of the United Democratic Parties, including the party leader Usainu Darboe, they are all serving 3-year jail term. What is Amnesty doing about this?
Amnesty is really concerned because what is happening in Gambia right now, and we have been calling for in several occasions to several institutions and including to the Gambia government of the immediate and unconditional release of all prisoners of conscience. Amnesty International considers that these people from the UDP that were on the streets, that defending their freedom of expression, just using the right to express themselves freely, should be released immediately because they haven't done anything wrong and the human rights should be protected. So they should be released immediately.
Now, under the present circumstances in the Gambia, when members of the main opposition party are all arrested, some of them are now serving jail sentence. Now, do you believe that there could be free and fair elections in the Gambia come the 4th of December this year?
Amnesty is not a political organization, so we don't have any opinion about political systems and political elections. What we are really concerned is about the human rights situation. We think that everything should be put in place, that people from Gambia should have protect their freedom of expression, the freedom of association, the freedom of a peaceful assembly. So these are our main concerns, and we really want that if it's going to be elections in Gambia, all these human rights should be protected by them.
The Gambians people themselves, they have been always listening to these international human rights organizations like Amnesty because they believe that Amnesty is advocating for change in most of these countries where they believe that the rule of law is not observed. Now, it is now election time and the Gambian people believe that maybe they will be threatened, some of them will be arrested during the political campaign. Are you preparing any kind of advocacy or any kind of program to sensitize the Gambian people regarding the election campaign and etc.?
Gambian people should know that the international community are watching what is happening in Gambia, that they are really concerned about the human rights and their freedoms. The latest incidents have been condemned by ECOWAS, by the African Union, by the UN, the European Union, all the international community, countries, institutions, and other organizations are condemning this lack of human rights and lack of freedoms in the Gambia. So people from Gambia should know that they are not alone, that there are people that care about the human rights, and that we really hope that one day human rights are going to be a reality in Gambia.
That was Marta Colomer Aguilera of Amnesty International. She was speaking with reporter Alpha Diallo in Dakar. The French foreign minister is insisting that a constitutional court must be impartial and transparent in ruling on a challenge to the narrow re-election victory of Ali Bongo Ondimba in Gabon. Presidential challenger Jean Ping yesterday filed a challenge to the less than 6,000 vote margin of Bongo's victory. EU monitors have questioned the results in Bongo's home province. And UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has welcomed the final stage of removal of Libya's chemical stockpile. The last Libyan chemical weapons stock has been shipped to Germany to be destroyed. Libya joined the UN Convention banning chemical weapons in 2004 and began destroying its stocks, but the process was interrupted by the uprising against Muammar Gaddafi in 2011. Senior Middle East reporter Mohammed El-Shenawi asked military expert Michael O'Hanlon of the Brookings Institution just how significant is the removal of Libya's weapons.
Well, it's good. Obviously, we don't like chemical weapons, and we like to see arms control regimen is respected. But I don't think that most of the conflict in the Middle East today, in places from Syria to Libya to wherever, is fundamentally about chemical weapons. And I'm not going to get too happy about any particular milestone on the chemical demilitarization front when these wars go on. So it's a small positive step in the context of a very bad overall regional situation where the nature of the conflict is not fundamentally affected by the elimination of chemical weapons.
But the chemical weapons had been stored about 125 miles south of Sirte, which was a stronghold for the so-called Islamic State group. Was it crucial to remove these weapons from that specific site?
Well, I'm very happy that the odds of the Islamic State getting access to any kind of weapon of mass destruction or highly destructive weapon, the odds have been reduced, or at least I should say I'm relieved. But I guess I would not say that I'm happy, because, again, the conflict continues and many, many people continue to die. And there's no reason to think that the elimination of one particular type of weapon, especially this one particular type, is going to make any fundamental difference in the course of the conflict. So, yes, insofar as it goes, it's a positive development, but it does not challenge the basic contention that this war is still more a bad news story than a good news story, and that things really are not fundamentally improving very much at all here in the late summer of 2016.
Will the elimination of Libyan chemical weapons somehow enhance the status of the Libyan government of national accord?
No, that one's easy. I don't think that most Libyans are fundamentally concerned about elimination of chemical weapons. That probably some people are relieved for the same reasons I am, and for them it's even more direct and personal, obviously. But people know that the reasons why there's been this big problem with figuring out who's going to be in charge of Libya, people disagree over the distribution of power. This was never about chemical weapons per se. So you wouldn't really expect that the mitigation of one particular kind of threat would lead to any kind of national consensus on anything else.
That's Michael O'Hanlon of the Brookings Institution in Washington. He was speaking with reporter Mohammed El-Shenawi. Seventeen past the hour, you're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Three countries on the continent are fighting to eliminate trachoma, the leading cause of infectious blindness worldwide if left untreated. Ethiopia, South Sudan, and Eritrea are working to help meet the World Health Organization's goal of eradicating the disease by the year 2020. Dr. Paul Emerson is Trachoma Control Program Director at the Task Force for Global Health, an Atlanta-based organization and recipient of this year's Hilton Humanitarian Prize. He told my colleague Kim Lewis how the three African countries have vastly different battles with trachoma, including one that's well ahead of its neighbors in eliminating the disease.
Trachoma has been very common throughout the world historically. It's now associated with underdevelopment, and unfortunately, that maps sub-Saharan Africa.
Looking at the country of Ethiopia, why does Ethiopia still have trachoma? Why is it still there?
It's a very enigmatic question. Ethiopia is known to be the most affected country in the world. In fact, 75 million of the 200 million people at risk of blinding trachoma are Ethiopians. So Ethiopia is a major challenge. In all honesty, we don't really know why Ethiopia has such a high prevalence. But thankfully, the Ethiopian government is taking the issue very seriously and is working very hard to get rid of the disease.
Actually, health workers are out there going door to door educating people. So do you think more of that needs to be done?
There needs to be intensified efforts, of course. In an elimination program, you have to do everything right all the time, everywhere. And that means intensifying health education. It means getting everyone an annual treatment with antibiotic donated by Pfizer. And it means providing surgical service to people who are with severe blinding trachoma and whose eyelids are about to start scratching their eyes out.
And of course, that is what leads to blindness. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. Trachoma is a terrible disease. In the late stages, the eyelids rotate around because they get drawn in and they rest against the eyeball. And as they rest against the eye, every blink becomes an excruciating pain as it cuts away at the cornea. That leads to secondary infections, pain, stigma, social isolation, and eventually blindness.
In looking at South Sudan, the ongoing conflict, how is this hindering efforts to fight trachoma in South Sudan?
The current conflict in South Sudan, of course, is a tragedy after 50 years of civil war and just a few years of peace. And during those few years of peace, huge strides were made in the health programs. Unfortunately, those strides seem to have been wiped out, and frankly, the people of South Sudan deserve considerably better than this after all they've been through. The insecurity is a terrible problem because obviously it's not possible for the ministry to put lives at risk whilst delivering health programs. So service has stopped in many places. However, it's not all bad. There are parts of South Sudan in which service can be delivered, and the people who are doing it are committing acts of heroism on a day-to-day basis.
Eritrea is experiencing success in their fight against trachoma, and you just were recently there. Can you tell us about Eritrea's fight?
Eritrea is a very interesting example. They have a very disciplined population and a very disciplined health delivery, and this has worked really well for communicable disease such as trachoma. They have reached the elimination targets in most of the country. There's just one or two places right on the border with Tigray in Ethiopia where there are still high levels of trachoma. But it looks like Eritrea are going to beat big neighbors to the south, Ethiopia, and their big neighbor to the west, Sudan, and reach elimination of blinding trachoma before them.
What exactly is going on there that is different from the other countries?
They have managed to tackle all of their problem at once. So instead of a staged approach to implementation, of course, in Sudan, they're hampered because of the insecure areas in Darfur. And in Ethiopia, we're hampered by the enormous size of the problem. Eritrea have taken the bull by the horns. They have a national program that works everywhere. And because of that, they've made progress everywhere.
Do you think other countries will look at Eritrea as an example and attempt to do the same?
I hope so. There aren't very many good news stories coming out of Eritrea. And I hope that with sustained donor commitment to the country, they are able to reach their target. And when they do, be held up as a good example, which will be very positive for the Ministry of Health in Eritrea.
Dr. Paul Emerson is Trachoma Control Program Director at the Task Force for Global Health, an Atlanta-based organization, and also a recipient of this year's Hilton Humanitarian Prize. He spoke with reporter Kim Lewis from Mexico City. Sunday, September 11th, is the 15th anniversary of the worst terrorist attack on American soil in the nation's history. That's when terrorists hijacked four airliners. Two slammed into the World Trade Center in New York and one at the Pentagon in Washington, D.C. The fourth crashed in a lonely Pennsylvania field. For some Americans, 9/11 is seen today as an historical event seen from afar. For others, the day remains a vivid memory that still brings personal pain. VOA's Adam Phillips recently visited Times Square in New York City to ask passersby what September 11th, 2001 meant to them on that day and what it has come to mean since.
When the World Trade Center towers collapsed, they spread a cloud of gray ash made of debris mixed with human remains over many kilometers. Francis Donlan takes an extra deep drag on his Marlboro and recalls his 9/11.
Well, I was working at that time in Brooklyn for a bus company, and I happened to be in the yard where the buses were, and I could actually see the ashes looked like a snowstorm coming into the yard there. I didn't realize what it was. Nothing like that ever happened before in America. So it was a tremendous shock. It was a horror. Oh, yeah, something I don't like to think about. I mean, look at all the families that were destroyed, all the children that lost moms and dads. Whole lives were changed.
Did your life change?
My life didn't change, no. I can't say it did change. It made me a little more fearful.
Native New Yorker Gary Kaminsky has his own harrowing memories. He and his family had moved across the river to New Jersey, but he continued to work as a business executive in Midtown Manhattan. Within minutes of the second tower's collapse, Kaminsky and his colleagues were called into the boss's office and told to go home and await word.
My first thought was, well, how am I going to get out of the city and get home? But the one thing that really stood out of my mind was walking down 7th Avenue with hundreds of people right in the middle of the street with no cars, no traffic. Storefronts were shut and the gates were down on most of them. It seemed like something out of a movie years in the future where the city was barren and here we are walking down 7th Avenue. So it was a day that I'll never forget. The city has definitely become much more security conscious in the 15 years. Every morning there are National Guardsmen with rifles and police with assault weapons.
Canada-born Chaim Kind had never seen anything as dramatic as September 11th and its aftermath, except in the movies and in history books. He says the media coverage he saw on TV seemed unreal, surreal, and all too real all at once.
Almost like when I think about Armenia or the Holocaust in 1945, it just seemed like it wasn't really happening. It was horrific. So now I'm going to spend the next few days actually thinking about what I actually feel about it. How do we feel? How are we progressing? What trauma are we facing? How has it affected our society?
Doug Portner, who operates a Times Square food truck, says September 11, 2001 continues to be a theme in his own life and in the lives of his city and the nation. He spent most of that day fretting about his father, a police officer.
It's actually my father's birthday, and he was a cop down there, so, you know, it's hard to contact him and everything. It was a difficult situation. It sticks with you, you know.
Was your father okay?
Oh, my dad was okay, yeah, but he knew a lot of cops and friends that were lost, so, you know, it just gets very emotional. You know, now that it's the 15th anniversary, it's just like, wow, I can't believe it's been 15 years already. Like, where'd the time go? So, like, working up here in Times Square is, like, there's bomb threats all the time, and that's all, like that's one of the things I think of, like, but, you know, the New York City cops, you know, they're there to help us. But, you know, things could happen, you know, in a split second.
As the terrorist attacks of 2001 fade farther into the past, it'll fall to survivors, witnesses, policymakers, historians, and everyday people to try to understand what those events signified at the time and what they might come to mean over the decades and centuries. Curiosity and mourning are both very much alive at Ground Zero itself. The National September 11th Memorial and Museum has hosted nearly 7 million visitors from around the world since it opened in 2014. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports, coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Mark Ferguson, thanks for choosing and the Voice of America.
Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in Feast your ears and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.